So, you know, the web page or whatever is just something that you guys do for fun. Do you have a real job?
Well, that is our job.
Oh.
We don't technically get money for the hours we put in, but it is our job.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
How come you don't have any money? I thought you had a paper route.
Well, I'm taking a sabbatical to focus on my pottery.
Oh. How's that working out?
Not good, Meg. Not good.
What I thought was interesting, too, about that story with the crashed saucer that the aliens lived on for 6 months was they got rescued. They left the ship there.
Uh-huh.
And then the government came and built a reservoir, so they took the land away from the guy. And it seems he doesn't know for sure. No one really knows for sure if the government ever found the saucer, but you almost think that it may have.
Well, he thought they did.
Mm.
He thought they took it away, that they found it and they took it away. And I said, well, how in the world could they carry something that size out of here? He said, well, you know what it's like. You know, they put it under a tarp and haul it away. And the people themselves were so in awe of the big machinery they brought there, you know, and
yeah.
would stand along the side of the road just to see it, you know, so they wouldn't think anything about it. And of course, unless they had been away, too, they probably hadn't heard of UFOs, you know. A lot of these guys had heard about these things, these elders, because they were in World War One or World War Two, you know.
Yeah.
World War Two, and had been away and knew about stuff like this, you know. And but it's been an interesting 20-25 years that I've had collecting these stories.
Oh yeah, it sounds that way. And I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to make this too much of a downer note here, but I couldn't help but notice that a good number of the people who shared their stories with you, they've passed away since
right.
telling you the stories.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was interesting. Was that just a result of how long you've been doing this research, or?
I mean, part of it, because some of them told me the stories. When they told me the stories, they were elders, you know.
Right.
You know, I've been doing this research for such a long time, and many of the people, even if they told me, if they were in their 50s, you know, many of them have passed.
Mm.
And then the more recent stories I collected, though, haven't, you know, they're still fine. They're still around.
Yeah, that's good.
But a lot of the elders are gone, yeah.
Well, did you get the impression that maybe this was, you know, earlier you talked about the plow driver in Alaska and how you thought he needed to get this off his chest. Do you think that was sort of an indication with some of these folks that, you know, they were getting older and they wanted, you know, they kind of wanted this on the record, even if it was anonymous?
You know, I never thought of it in those terms. It could have been. I just don't know. I can't. I know that some of them told me they would like, that they would like their story to be told, you know, but as long as they were sure that nobody would know who they were. But I don't know if that was a motivation or not. I never asked them.
Well, the great part about the book is, you know, it's, you hear from the skeptics all the time, but like, when you read the book, it really, I cannot, because maybe I'm not as cynical as some of the skeptics, but I cannot fathom a reason why, like, an 80-year-old dude is going to make up a story about a UFO that he's only going to tell one person and then also tell you. Like, that doesn't make any sense to me that this would be a fabrication. And that happens again and again and again in the book.
Well, and that's true. And some of those people I knew 20-25 years before they ever told me their stories. You know, I mean, they, you know, I think there was a real trust factor there that had to be achieved before they told me their stories. Because,
right.
And so some of them knew me a long time before they ever told me their stories. And they were, you know, I knew them when they were in their 50s or early 60s, and here they are at 80 years old saying, well, I have a story that never told anybody, but, you know, maybe it's time to tell it. And so it was, and I felt really privileged, and I felt humbled that I was the one that they chose to tell the story to.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Like I said, these are such incredibly rare stories that, again, I go back to the idea, why would, you know, just, you know, to take the devil's advocate point of view and try and poke holes in this, it's, you know, personally for me, it's impossible. I can't really come up with any, you know, the only sort of justification I can think of is to add some allure, I guess, maybe, to the American Indians. But I can't understand.
Well, and I have no interest in
doing
that. You know?
Right, exactly.
And, you know, I've spent my career working with Native people, and, you know, I'm not, I consider myself professional.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, would never, even consider such a thing, because I really, you know, I wanted to present, as they told me, and I hope that the honesty and the sincerity of the people came across. That was the most important thing to me, to let people, to give people an idea that this wasn't just some big story that somebody was making up or
exactly,
they had dreamed.
Yeah.
Or
I wasn't intimating that you were adding to the allure. I'm just sort of like trying to think of what the critics would say, the skeptics would say, and it's
the skeptics say, well, you know, you don't tell who they are, you don't. You know, I think those are the criticisms
I
get, is that I'm not willing to tell them who they are, and I'm not. If they want to say, well, discount it for that reason. But I think you're going to be amazed with the next book that comes, because I have some, I'm traveling through Central America and Mexico, if you can imagine, and I don't have any contacts or anything in terms of how I'm going to, you know, is anybody going to talk to me? How am I going to find out anything about UFOs and you know, there's a language barrier, there's a cultural barrier, there's a gender barrier, you know, just a lot of things that I thought, well, you know, I'm just going to ask. And I remember going to Palenque, and as I enter Palenque, a young Maya man approaches me and says, have you heard about our Pacal, our ancient astronaut, out of the clear blue sky? And I'm thinking, how could this happen? I'm here, you know, to learn about these things, and here I am being approached by a young man asking me, just have you, and no, I hadn't said a word. I mean, I hadn't uttered a word. I just had paid my money to get into the site. And of course, you know, he's featured in Erich von Däniken's book, you know, and he describes how he's in a spaceship and, you know, doing all these different kinds of things. And that's how I was approached. And over, just a lot of things a lot of the stories I was told there were, well, the majority of the stories just happened by chance. And I think that's what makes these stories so interesting, is it's not something that somebody has a chance to plan.
Right.
Or, you know, to make up. It just happens by chance, and you, people sit down and tell you a story.
Exactly. This isn't a situation where, like, you know, you're rolling in with a TV crew to,
right,
you know, wrangle people to go tell you these stories.
Right.
These just happen when you're talking to them and stuff. And,
yeah,
and in some instances, you get the impression that the witness is kind of, there's one where, there's a couple where the witnesses are kind of gruff at first with you. You can kind of tell they're sizing you up to make sure that you're on the level.
Right.
So I thought that was pretty interesting.
It was certainly an interesting journey for me, and I do hope my readers enjoy it, and I appreciate you, you know, having me on your show.
Oh, absolutely. It's been a pleasure. We're not done yet, though, are you? So.
Oh, okay. I thought it was an hour interview.
Oh, can we go a little longer?
I didn't know it was
2 hours, so.
Okay.
We got plenty more to talk about. I wanted to ask you, this goes completely off the rails here, of the subject of the book. Tell me a little bit about what you've heard about Bigfoot.
I didn't hear anything from American Indians.
Oh, okay.
Now, I heard shape-shifting stories,
right,
but not Bigfoot stories. The only Bigfoot stories I heard were in Mexico.
Interesting.
But it may be, you know, a lot of the Bigfoot stories, I think, come out of the Northwest, like Oregon and Washington and Idaho, and maybe some even in Montana. But none of the stories, I was not told any Bigfoot stories by American Indians. I was told about little people, but not about
Well, tell me about these. Tell me now. I'm interested in this. Tell me about these little people.
Well, a lot of the native cultures have stories about little people that intervened in people's lives, and one day I just happened to be visiting with a student, and we were talking about stories, and I was telling him about little people, and he said, "Well, I have a story to tell you." And so then he told me about when he was a young boy, how he had gotten this bicycle, and he loved going to school because he could ride this bicycle, and he had wanted this bicycle for so long, and his mother told him that he could ride this bicycle as long as it didn't snow. Every morning he would jump out of bed and ride his bicycle to school. And this morning that it snowed, he was told he couldn't ride his bicycle, so he decided he was going to skip school. And so he heads out, and he's going to go up in the mountains and just spend the day fooling around, you know, playing in the snow. And there's the old man wolf lives up on the hill there, and he was trying to get by the old man's house, and the old man caught him and told him that he couldn't go up there because the little people were there. And so here were these little tiny footprints in the snow. And, you know, it was just amazing, the story, you know, how he talked about following those little footsteps. And when they get up to the top of the mountain, how there's a clearing there. And in that clearing was that round circle where there was no snow. And then they catch the glimpse of this craft going through the sky, and the old man said, and their legends, they had legends about these people, these little people who came and who were still children. So from then on, you know, he would, every year he would climb that mountain, this old man. And the old man was kind of a mentor to him. And when he was graduated from high school, he went to tell him that he had been drafted to go to Vietnam. And the old man said, you know, he was a man now, and he didn't have to worry about him, indicating from what he felt was that, you know, they only steal children. Now you're a man, I don't have to worry. You know, you're going to war. So, So it was a really an interesting story, and, you know, not one that I would have ever thought, you know, that I would ever hear, but what a touching story that he told me, his relationship over the years, you know, with that elder who always looked out for him while he was still a boy.
And the legend said that the little people stole children.
Yeah, that's what their legends, you know, that they would steal people and steal children and never see them again.
Well, one of the go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, well, that rings a bell for me from having read the book of another guy who tells a story. I think he's abducted, and he says that he thinks, and he just sort of is going on in his intuition, but he says he thinks that there are people that are abducted and not brought back, that's another chilling
yeah.
aspect of the book.
Yes, and I thought a lot about that, because, you know, you always hear of people that come up missing and nobody ever hears of them again. And, you know, what is that? Is actually, what is going on?
Yeah, it makes you wonder.
You know, I mean, you can figure that some of these missing cases, obviously, are, you know, are crimes.
Yeah.
But what about the ones that we never find the people?
It makes you wonder, because there's a lot of missing people out there, and it's an underreported story in a lot of ways.
Well, in that case, you know, the family disappeared, and just everyone accepted the fact that, you know, they had been taken away by.
Right, that's a story in the book too.
Gone.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, you mentioned. Yeah,
the whole family was gone.
That just the whole family disappears, never comes back, and the it's just generally accepted that they were taken by star people.
Right, and it just that was just the way it was, you know, and it's interesting because they said, you know, on this particular area, you know, the star people used to come and leave messages for the people, and then they quit coming. You know, there's a story that is told about a place in Arkansas where the star people used to come and leave messages, and then it was all this, it was in a cave, and then all of this was destroyed when the state set up a state park in that area. And they said that it was considered a sacred site by several different tribes that would come there. And so, you know, I've heard of that was interesting to me, an interesting connection.
Yeah. Now, what do you mean? Maybe you can extrapolate on messages. What do you mean?
Meant, you know, that they never explained that to me. And even though I asked them, they would just say that they used to come and leave messages. And I'd say, well, what kind of messages? And they would say, well, messages just, how to live and those kinds of things. And I would say, well, how did they leave those messages? And no one had an answer. So I'm not sure what they meant, but they would just say they would come and leave messages.
That's weird.
And I don't know if they told somebody or, you know, if some, you know, they just didn't, they would just say, well, they just came and left messages.
So that's strange, yeah.
Yeah.
And just to enlighten people a little bit more on this story about the family that disappeared, I think we were talking about like 14 people, and it was like the house was pristine when they left. The dinner was on the table.
Right,
you know,
everything.
Yeah.
And this was out, you know, I mean, this was in a pretty isolated part of the reservation. It wasn't so far away that you couldn't maybe see your neighbor 3 miles away because, you know, this was pretty flat land out there. But, you know, you could see their lights at night. You could probably see their house if you, you know, had binoculars or something. But they just disappeared. And it was just assumed that, well, they had seen, you know, some craft in the area. And so it just figured that they'd gone away. They'd gone with the Star People.
So interesting. I find the whole matter of factness of it so interesting.
Well, you know, they even had, you know, apparently, you know, some of the elders tell them that's what, you know, had happened. So
very strange. Very strange. Now, you mentioned the Indian boarding schools a few times, and it's come up a bunch of times in the stories, and this is something that I'd never heard of ever. So, I mean, I'd heard about the awfulness of the reservation and all the persecution of the Native Americans, but I'd never heard the story about how these Native American children were taken and sent to boarding schools and indoctrinated into sort of this European culture, if you will. So I guess talk about that, because that's such a untold era in American history, surprisingly. I mean, I really haven't heard much about it at all, if ever, actually, until I read the book.
Boarding schools are set up all over the country, and basically they were set up, the federal government gave, basically the Catholic Church, these missions to set up boarding schools to teach Indian children how to survive in the non-Indian world. And so many of these schools, the children would be taken at 6 years of age, and many, many of them, the children never got to go home. In the summer times, they would, the priests and nuns would loan them out to local farmers.
Oh God.
And then the farmers, and they would pay them money, for the services of the kids, but the kids never saw any of the money. You know, the church got the money. And they could be quite brutal. A lot of corporal punishment, many of the children, when they got there, you know, they shaved their heads, and they had long hair, and they were given white names. They were told they were no longer, could go by their Indian names. I've been told stories by, people that, went to the boarding school and never spoke a word the entire time they were there, because they said that, you know, they weren't allowed to speak their language, so they just sat there and played dumb. I've been told stories of kids that were beaten, girls that were raped. It was not a good time in American history,
right?
You know, and there's still some boarding schools in existence, but the ones that are in existence today are, I think, pretty decent schools. I had some nephews that went to one and, you know, just thrived. They really enjoyed going there. But that was a part of American history, and it wasn't until the 60s that there was dramatic change, and then you started seeing the Indian-controlled schools, where schools are actually built on the reservations and with Indian school boards, just like the small-town public school board. Well, now you've got Indians that had control over the education of their children. But this went on for a very long time in American history. And the children, once they went home, many of them had lost their language skills, they had forgotten their culture, they didn't fit in anywhere. They didn't fit in the white culture, and they didn't fit in the Indian culture either. So I think, that is a really sad part of American history. Same thing happened in Canada. Hmm. The Canadian, same thing happened in Australia with the Aborigines in Australia. So it was something that is a part of our history, and it might not be talked about in history books, but it was a very difficult period for American Indians and their families, because having their children just torn away from them and put in these schools was a very difficult thing to deal with.
Oh,
and some of the people that I interviewed were in those boarding schools.
Hmm, yeah, that's how I heard about
right.
all this. I'd never even known about this this whole, I don't even know what you'd call it, this tactic, I guess you could say. It's really heartbreaking, and you can see why there's such a disconnect between the American Indians and the country.
And the mainstream society.
I
think it's true. And what happened to, and those are the kind of things I think that where so many things were lost, so many things were not passed down because the mothers couldn't teach the daughters and fathers couldn't teach the sons it created a major problem. And then you have people coming back to the reservation. They have been educated in these boarding schools. And now they're young adults and they're getting married and they're having children and not even knowing how to raise children because, you learn to raise children by being raised by your parents. Your parents teaching you.
Yeah.
So became a real disconnect. And it's often talked about in the literature, talking about historical trauma, the kinds of trauma that takes place over centuries of disconnect, and then one day, all this stuff comes together and you start thinking about, well, look what happened. We need to resolve this before we can move forward, come to grips with what really happened to us as a people.
Well, I appreciate the insight on that because, like I said, I'd never even heard about it, and it was stunning to me that this happened.
Well, fortunately, really today most Native children are able to go to school right in their own hometown, and right on the reservation where they grew up, but it wasn't that way until. Basically, what happened is you had the Catholic missionaries, they were the ones that started. And, of course, what they taught was the Bible. They taught them people to read from the Bible.
Right.
Everything was according to the doctrine of the Catholic Church. And they would have religious classes, and then in the afternoon they would teach sewing to the girls and farming to the boys. That kind of thing is what went on in the schools, and basically what they were doing was sewing their own clothes and cooking and stuff, to keep the school running. And the boys were farming with vegetables and stuff that they were actually eating, so it was kind of like a little slave labor camp. And then you had, after the government, you had separation of church and state, and here's the government giving money, to a church, to church organizations for these boarding schools. And then you had the Bureau of Indian Affairs created, where the Bureau of Indian Affairs then took over the running of the schools, which was just as bad, because they weren't educators and they didn't. But there's still a lot of BIA schools out there right now, so I'll probably get in trouble. But not as many.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure it's not as bad as it was back in the day, so I mean,
No, it's much better. I say, there aren't very many of them left. But the ones that are in existence, do a pretty good job of educating and caring about kids, you know?
Yeah. There was one story, just I guess to turn it around here and to talk a little bit about something a little more lighthearted. There was one great story in the book about the guy who he thought the aliens were going to steal his dog. The aliens were eyeing his dog. I love that one. Yeah.
Chauncey, he was a wonderful man. Yes, well, you know, he said that his dog was just putting up a fuss, so he opens the door and lets the dog out, and the dog takes around the side of the house barking. And he grabs his shotgun to go out to see what the dog is barking at. He thinks maybe there's, you know, something out there. Hmm. And so he goes out there. And when he turns around the side of the house, he gets a glimpse of something that is leaning over his dog, and he thinks something is trying to kill his dog. So he shoots at it to scare it away. And it's this alien-like creature, you know, this pale, small, what he perceived as a very weak entity, dressed in what he thought were pajamas, he said, that were shiny and silvery. And later, he asks this entity, where he's from, how did he get there? And he said, well, you know, he came from the sky. And so Chauncey and his dog walk with him to where his craft has landed behind this butte. And along the way, you know, he gives this dog a command and the dog obeys. And the alien becomes quite interested in the fact that this dog obeys his commands, and so he demonstrates some things for him, kind of showing off. And when they get to the craft, the alien wants the dog, and he just takes his gun and points it in. You know, my dog stays here, and the alien got the message and went away. But he said they keep coming back. Well, I was really touched by his story because, you know, I mean, his grandkids called him the man who shot the alien, you know, and it was kind of a joke, you know, how he would go out there and shoot at this alien, you know, to keep him away from his dog. And the day he died, you know, I went to the funeral and I was talking to his granddaughter, and I said, you know, I'd gone out back and everybody was kind of, they eating and everything, and I went out there, and the dog was lying on the grave. They had buried him there at his place, and the dog was lying on his grave, and, you know, I got down on the ground. I was holding that dog, and I just felt so sorry for the dog, and I would have taken him home with me if they had said, just take him, you know?
Yeah.
Because I've been known to do things like that, and the granddaughter said, oh, don't worry about him, you know, he just needs time to grieve. She says, we're going to come back tomorrow, and we're going to pick him up. We're just going to let him stay here tonight. And so a few weeks later, I'm up in that area, and I stop at the school where she works, and I said, we're just talking about the holidays and everything, and I asked her about the dog, and she said, well, he came up missing. And Chauncey always told me, you know, he says, those aliens, they keep coming back here. They want my dog. And they keep flying over, and every time they come back, he says, you know, blue hides, because they're coming for my dog. And he was just convinced of that. And here his dog is missing, and they never found him. And I just thought, oh, my goodness. All the way home, I was thinking, oh, those aliens got his dog, you know.
And yeah.
Poor Chauncey, all these years he had protected his dog. And I thought, boy, I better get home to mine. I don't want to take any chances with her being by herself, you know.
Yeah, it's so, yeah. Well, the story reminded me of another story in the book, and that's the girl with the horses. And she says, again, we're getting some interesting insights here that we definitely have never heard in a lot of other places. And she says that the aliens told her they wanted to know how to take care of horses because they got some horses.
Right.
And the horses aren't doing too well.
Right.
which I thought was really like, whoa, here's something that I've never, another thing that I've never heard before, which is tremendous.
Well, and you know, we've heard stories. In fact, it wasn't the first, one of the first examples of animal mutilation. Wasn't that a horse? In UFO, history. And now, you know, you're hearing this alien tell her that they have some horses and the horses are not, they're dying. And what is she, what are they supposed to do to take care of these horses? And I found that one fascinating, you know, that she was, when she told me that story.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting because beyond the cattle mutilation part of it, it's, you know, it's, again, we're getting sort of an insight into maybe what the veil being lifted a little bit on their end, on the ET's end, where it's like,
well,
they're not just fascinated by people, they seem to be taken aback by animals, too.
And I don't think I've read that much in the literature about that.
Right.
I don't think I've read anything, come to think of it.
Not until Encounters with Star People.
Right.
So that's why I love the book.
Well,
I wonder
if other people have encountered that and they just haven't talked about it. You know, because there's so much, you know, skepticism and one of the things I often ask some of the people that I was interviewing is, why do you think that you see these things and nobody else, you know, you don't have other people telling these kind of stories? And
right.
Part of they say, well, because we're not so sure they're open to it. They're open to this kind of interaction because instead of accepting it for what it is, they're fearful.
Hmm.
Because, you know, a lot of the stories around interaction with aliens is abduction and performing, you know, all of these different experiments on them. So people are more fearful and not open to open communication and maybe that is the case. And then a lot of them felt that so much is going on that people just aren't looking anymore. People don't sit out on their porches and watch the sky and tell stories at night. They sit in their houses and play computer games and watch TV.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And there's some truth to that, too, you know, that we don't spend the kind of time. I mean, when I was growing up as a child, that's how we spent our evenings, was outside, you know, sitting on the porch watching the night sky and listening to stories or visiting with the neighbors. I mean, that was part of life. And I don't think people do much of that anymore. I mean, our houses don't even have front porches anymore.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Yeah, we've become a very a society that's sort of become afflicted with this sort of tunnel vision. You know, we're always stuck in the box of the internet or the television or entertainment of some kind.
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, I noticed that a lot of the events too happen when people are out, you know, they're traveling and they see these things and they would probably see the same thing from their front porch if they ever, you know, sat down and just watched the sky.
Mm. Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
But they, you know, our lives are so busy and we're a whole different society than. But you take on an Indian reservation where people still do those kinds of things, you know, because you live out in the country and, you know, you still visit with your neighbors and you still sit out and watch the sky at night. And not to say that people don't have computers, but a lot of them don't have computers, you know, a lot of them don't. And they still live the way, people have in a, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Now, you said that you have 1,000 stories, or over 1,000
right.
stories, and I don't know the exact number in the book, but I'd say probably, let's say, 24.
Yeah.
So, I mean, what kind of stuff didn't make it into the book that was close or that you'd like to maybe follow up on or publish in a future date? Give us some kind of some teasers of stuff that even I haven't heard yet, because I've already read the book. So what kind of stuff is out there that we haven't heard yet from you?
I had this husband and wife come to Montana State University as a couple students that were going to school.
Mm-hmm.
And one day the husband was, they were in my office, and the wife left. And he looked at me and he said, "I've always loved that woman." And I said, "Well, that's really nice to hear a husband say that about his wife." And he said, "Oh," he said, "you wouldn't believe." He said, "I first saw her on a spaceship."
Oh, wow.
And he told me the story about how he, along with probably 20, 30 other little kids, were in this large room. And he saw this girl, and he tried to communicate with her. And it was like she was totally in some kind of a stupor, not communicating, but he was very attracted to her. And he said he never forgot her. And he met her, and he knew that's who she was. But he never told her. And he said one day after they got married, they were at her mother's house, and they were going through this old trunk. And here she pulled out the dress she was wearing the night he saw her on that spacecraft. And he said that he had told her, you know, that he saw her once on a spacecraft, and she says, "You're out of your mind." and he said, "Here was this dress that she was wearing," and he said, as soon as he saw it, he knew that she was the one because of the dress.
Did it ever click in with her that this happened, or just
apparently not? Okay. You know, but he was telling me the story after she left. You know she was just so beautiful, and he described the dress and everything. And he said, then years later, when he saw her, he was positive that was the girl he had fallen in love with when they were children. And then and he told her that, he said, "I met you once on a spacecraft and you wouldn't even talk to me." And she thought he was nuts. And he said, then when they were going through all these things, here's this dress. And her mother had saved this dress, saying that maybe someday she would have a little girl, and this little girl would want to wear this dress, you know. And so she had put her away. And he said, "I knew then." He said, "I met my wife on a spacecraft." So I think that was an interesting story. I mean, you know, there were just a lot of little stories like that. That a lot of stories that didn't make it into the book.
Right.
That were just as unusual. I mean, I didn't expect somebody to tell me a story like that, but.
Oh, no, it's fascinating.
And I've heard stories of things that happened to students when they were out, a couple of my students when they were out hunting, and lost time and became, there is one hunting story, I think, in the book, but this is a totally different story. What happened to them and missing all that time and getting back home, and they were like 2 days late, and their family had sent out people looking for them because they were due back on Sunday night, and they didn't return, and they had no idea that they had lost all this time.
Yeah.
And know it. They remember seeing the craft, but they didn't know what happened to them once they were gone. And so the family had called and sent out a search party, and here they estimate they probably lost a day and a half and had no idea where it went.
Weird.
So I think any of the stories would have made a good book.
Oh, absolutely.
But at some point, you know, you have to quit writing and say,
yeah,
these are the best.
Well, these are tremendous. These
well,
stories are
you.
Tremendous. I mean, I've been fawning over this book the last 2 hours, but I really do love it, and I hope folks go out and get it, because this is, if you're a student of the UFO phenomenon, this one is a must-read. So I highly recommend it.
Well, I think you'll find the next one just as interesting.
I can't wait.
It's a different approach, because obviously on this one it was more of like a case study approach.
Yeah.
The next one will be, you know, chronicling. It will chronicle my trip through Honduras, Belize, Honduras, and Guatemala, and then into Mexico. Following in the footsteps of these ancient explorers and the individuals I meet along the way and the stories that they have to tell me. And some of the stories are quite amazing. And like I said, some of it, you know, like I was stopped at a roadblock by the military. And they asked me to get out of the car and sit along the side of the road. And while they are searching through my suitcases and everything, and I'm sitting there, and one of the young men spoke very good English, and he began to ask me all about myself and what I was doing. And so when I began to tell him, you know, he says, well, I have a story to tell. And so he sits there, and all of them sit there, and they add things to it because they all experienced, they were part of what had happened. So they told me their story. And, so it was, those are the kinds of things that happened to me, in Mexico and going through Central America, that people would just by chance, sometimes I would meet people that would have a story to tell.
Right, right. Very interesting. You almost wonder if it's, you know, something in the ether or some kind of, you know, like they know that you're sympathetic to this.
Well, I think the thing, you know, that about, you know, with me, I have, you know, I always say, you know, I'm not a hard scientist. I'm a social scientist. I'm somebody that has always looked for, you know, like what we call the people from the hard sciences are the people who have got to have proof for everything. And
yeah,
they've got to have, you know, they get out with their tape measures and their cameras and their,
yeah,
you know, their radiation meters. I'm a social scientist and I'm interested in your story.
Mm.
And if you have a story to tell, I will sit and I will listen. And I won't make any judgments because that's what I do. And I think, you know, that people in general, regardless of what culture you're from, they know if you are, a sincere person or if you're somebody out there trying to take advantage. And that's something else I want to say, you know, I've been criticized by saying that, you know, she's just out here exploiting American Indians. And, I donated a portion of all the proceeds from this book, any proceeds that I get. And that's even without taking anything, whatever I get from the publishing company, part of that goes to a scholarship fund that I set up 10 years ago, 15 years ago at Montana State, that I funded myself for Native American students to go to college. And so that part of this money will go for that, because I think that's important. It's important to me that Native people have a chance, and I've promoted that all my life, and I will promote it even after I'm gone, because that scholarship will always be there. I set up a foundation, or not a foundation, but through the MSU Foundation, a scholarship.
Yeah.
And so part of the proceeds of this book will go to that, because I'm not interested in exploiting my people or making a lot of money off of them, you know.
I hate to break it to you, Artie, but this is the UFO field. You're not going to make a lot of money anyway.
I know.
So.
You know, not only am I not going to make a lot of money, you know, my publisher told me that. You know, it's just not, it just doesn't happen.
Right. Now, since you're such a big part of academia up there in Montana, have you run into any sort of, you know, blowback or friction for, you know, getting into this oftentimes ridiculed subject of UFOs and whatnot?
Well, I haven't, but then I haven't seen anybody from the university. I doubt that they will take objection to if it means money going into the, you know, into the scholarship fund.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, it may not be a lot, but, you know, it may mean that another student can go to college every year, you know, so... you know, that's important to me. And but no, I haven't been in contact with anyone. And
so you didn't run into anybody who's like objected to you writing the book or tried to warn you.
Well, the
you
only
off
objections I've received have been a couple of people who've accused me of trying to exploit people for money, and
that's just ridiculous.
I didn't do that. You know, and like you say, I'm not going to get rich from this book, you know, not when you get 10% of the selling cost, you know, you're not going to make a lot of money.
Exactly.
I did what I thought was right, and that was to tell their stories.
Well, you did a tremendous job, and you know, top to bottom, from the stories to you yourself, this whole thing, there's an air of sincerity to it that is really undeniable. Like I said, it's ridiculous to accuse you of exploiting these people, and I don't think that the people telling the stories, I can't imagine why, again, I go back to it, I can't imagine why they'd be making up these stories. So I'm not sure what you can necessarily do with the stories other than collect them, because
to tell them.
Right, exactly. I mean, they're not exactly probably going to lead to us figuring out what this is all about, but it's very, very important that these stories get documented so we can, maybe they'll add a little piece to the puzzle that we hadn't considered before.
And that's what I hope they do, you know, is that, and I think that's what many of the people who talk to me hope that they would do, that it would just give more information out there from a source that had not spoken out before. I mean, there are a few people who have written about, I think, is it Brad Steiger? He's had some, you know, interviews with Native people and done some different things. And of course, Nancy Red Star. But this book is unique, and it tells the story of the everyday person.
Hmm. Absolutely. Having heard all these stories now, you've heard over 1,000, and I know it's extremely difficult because this is such a complex phenomenon, but I mean, have you come to any sort of, I wouldn't say conclusions, because conclusions are always nebulous when you're dealing with this enigma, but I mean, do you have any sort of idea of what's going on with these UFOs and these ETs and what, you know, why they're coming here and maybe how long they've been here or any sort of, you know, do you have an overarching sort of idea of what this is all about?
Well, I really don't.
It's okay. You don't have to. I really don't.
I mean, I think for me, personally, I take comfort in knowing that we are not alone in this universe. But as far as what they're, if they have an agenda, I think it'd be presumptuous of me to even assume that I know what that might be. Yeah. I think if we look at the stars and we're not alarmist, we might be able to find out a lot more than what we have in the past. Because I think the information might be there. It's just that because there's this whole cult that has grown up around the star people and aliens and UFOs or whatever, and we just need to accept that they exist and perhaps try to learn from what's going on.
Right. Well, you mentioned I think you mentioned here in the preface that in the 70s it became popular to connect the Native Americans with with aliens. I guess talk a little bit about that, because I came into this way past the 70s, so I missed that, the sort of fad, if you will. But what was that all about?
Well, I think back in the 70s you started having people pick up on some of the star stories, and then you had coming out of Waters and some of the things he wrote about the Hopis, and the next thing you know, stories are coming out of Hopi country, which is one of the tribes that really maintains a silence and protects their culture and their religions. You have all these stories coming out that about wars in the sky with spacecraft sightings of UFOs and all of a sudden, you know, you have this kind of concept coming forth of that when the world comes to an end, there's going to be a rapture, that the space aliens are going to take a group to the sky and, you know, protect them and all this kind of stuff. And I think the New Agers really bought into that. They started and they added to it. You had all these writers who became very famous, and they did become very rich, writing Chariots of the Gods with Eric Van Daniken. I think he was one of the first ones. But you had all these people writing about ancient astronauts and picking up on this kind of stuff, and they sold millions of books about this.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Maya calendar added to all that here in the, you know, as the years approached. And, you know, you went to Mexico in 2000, nobody even knew anything about the Maya calendar or anything. But you go there, you know, I mean, I have friends down in Mexico that said it was just like a, you know, it was like a circus. You know, everybody out there praying and waiting for the saucers to land, and just all this crazy nonsense that was going on that had basically basically been created by people outside, you know, the cultures. And, you know, even I think the Mexican government bought into a lot of that because it was a way to get tourists there.
Yeah, that
so
makes
they
sense.
Just played it up to the hilt, you know, and, you know, you're always having these UFO sightings and everything coming out. And people actually, if you went on the internet, you'd see people thought that the spacecraft were going to come to these different these different Maya sites, and they were going to see them and they were going to take them away.
Oh, yeah.
And so all this, and it actually started back in the 70s. And I think, you know, it started with a lot of these writers that, I mean, you know, Eric Van Daniken, well, he wasn't even a, you know, an archaeologist. You know, he was just, and what has he written? 12 or 15 books, and they've all been million sellers. And people will come, and of course, even the archaeologist here and all the scientists say, you know, all this stuff is nonsense. But I've been in Mexico, and I've seen busloads of people coming in from Germany, for example, because in Germany, they really believe what he says. And so they all come in here to Mexico and come to see these alien gods and all these kinds of things. And I think that all of us, you know, they just promoted this. And there were some native people who got caught up in all that.
Well, I'm sure. So,
you know, just like everything else.
Well, it's the great part about the book is, you know, that you're just letting them tell the stories. You're not co-opting it and throwing it into some crazy theory or anything like that. These are just the stories.
Well,
know?
And
it's
I
like
have no
the
theory.
We established that.
I just have no theory about what's going on. I feel privileged to have been told the stories, to have them, you know, given to me. And I just hope that it in some way does help unravel the mystery that we've been dealing with for over a century now, or even longer than that, you know. In the book, I talk about some of the early sightings out here in the West, you know, by cowboys and miners and different people that lived out here that told these. And in fact, the one story out in California that happened in the 1800s where they said that it was, an abduction, for one of the first abduction stories.
Hmm.
The men that met that saw the spacecraft land, and they went to see them, and they tried to force them to get into their spacecraft. And remember, they said they had they were covered with little fuzzy hair all over their bodies.
Yeah.
And that happened in California. And then the same spacecraft, as they described it, was in newspapers all over the West and the Midwest of sightings of this craft. So I found some of those things when I was going back through the history and reading about it. The story about the disappearing Eskimo group up in, I think it was Yupik up in, or Nupik, Nupik, up in Canada. Now, if you go on the, Mounted Police site, they even make a point of saying that never happened.
Really?
That didn't happen in that little village. And I found that extremely interesting because why would they put that on there? This UFO, that there's no truth to this disappearing village and this UFO. And yet the stories abound up there in the North Country are told by people that did happen.
Yeah.
Of the disappearing village. So, you know, I just wrote what I was told.
Exactly. Well, you did a tremendous job, and you've done it.
Thank you.
You know, yeoman's work here, an invaluable service to the native peoples and to the UFO community. So, you know, kudos to you for your work. Now, what's the timetable for the next book? And I presume you say you I guess an homage to these travelers, but it's going to contain paranormal elements, right? These are going to be stories.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I think, you know, probably it's going to end up containing more of the paranormal elements than it is of the travel. What I ended up doing definitely was following in their footsteps. I went to all the sites that they went to.
Hmm.
And I talk about, not in great detail, of how different the place was than what they saw. in many cases, when I was traveling, a lot of the sites, I had to go and knock on doors and visit with people and find out where some of the sites were, and sometimes people let me onto their land that, it was private land where the sites were that these two had visited, and people were just really open. It's different in the culture, because there was a real respect that I was a university professor from the United States, and I was interested in these old stories.
Right.
I was interested in this information. So they looked at me in a completely different way than I was here, you know, in the United States. That was kind of an interesting difference. I'm working on the book now. I hope to have it finished, I would say by at least, the fall, and then decide where I'm going to publish it and, you know, that kind of thing.
Nice. Excellent. Excellent. And beyond that, you said you have enough for many more books. Do you
right.
anticipate this is going to become, you know, more stuff coming from you beyond that? Because I would love to read.
Well,
I would read anything that you got. That whatever you put out,
you know,
I want to get my hands on.
One of the things that I'd hope to do is do a 3-part series, and one would be with the native people of the South Pacific in Australia. Because I did a lot of traveling in collecting stories from the Aborigine in Australia and. In the Maori in New Zealand and different people in the islands down there. I have to take a good look at that and see if I have enough, you know, to write a book. But that's something that I'm planning to do.
Now, from that part of the world, did you hear anything that stood out as wholly unique from what you've heard by the American Indians? Was there anything that was like, wow, I've never heard this before?
Not anything that is totally unique. Mm. Certainly different circumstances and certainly different beliefs.
Yeah, yeah.
But
I didn't mean to put you on the spot with that question.
Well, I'm just trying to think, you know,
yeah.
I encountered One man told me a story about being taken on board a meeting a young woman at a party, and she was just extremely beautiful, and she looked she was very different looking, but he was just kind of mesmerized by her beauty. And that when he approached her and started talking to her, she invited him to go back to her place, and he claims her place was a spacecraft.
Oh, wow.
And that he, when he goes on board, that he's basically is held captive. And her brother comes, who's somebody that she says is her brother in human terms, and that he would be the same as her brother, and begins questioning him about different things, about the connections he had, relatives and family, and then they just release him.
Weird.
They're not interested in him.
That's strange.
Yeah, that's probably one of the most unusual ones I heard that I hadn't heard before.
Hmm.
But he felt they were looking for somebody that they could take away and mate with this young woman. That's what he thought.
Ah.
That they could literally remove from Earth, but because he had so many connections that it might.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, like
yeah,
who'd miss
might,
you kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, that they, you know, they were looking for somebody that nobody was going to notice going away.
Interesting.
So I thought that was an unusual story.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that one. That one's an
yeah,
I'll look
and,
forward
and,
to the Australia book.
Yeah, you know, just some. Actually, that story came out of New Zealand.
Interesting.
They're all very. They're you know, I got a lot of different stories to tell, and hopefully.
Well, I hope that you know put as many out as you can, because, like I said, I. I eagerly await whatever your next release is, because this book was just tremendous, and I've purposely, this is sort of the wrap-up part, so we're pretty much done.
Well, I do want to tell everybody who's out there listening, if you're in the area of Colorado, there's a lady down there in Colorado that I just have, I've communicated with her for a number of years, and her name is Judy Messaline. I think that's how you pronounce her name. Anyway, she moved to the mysterious valley outside of, out in the, just in the deserts of Colorado, down in southeastern Colorado, near a place called Hooper. And she built a UFO watchtower down there. And every year she has a conference, a UFO watchtower conference, and it's a very small conference. People are invited to come and camp out and stay. Well, the presenters, they all camp out there too, and she has a big campground, and I told her this year I'd come.
Awesome.
So, if you're available, any of you out there listening and want to make a trip to Colorado, to Hooper, July 27th and 28th, come on down, because I'll be there, and I'd love to see you and talk to you.
Do you know the name of this event?
Yeah, it's called the UFO Watchtower Conference, I think. And
it's UFOWatchtower.com. So
right. Is that
there.
What it is?
Mm-hmm. That's what
yeah.
it is.
And they will have the announcement on there. And but she told me that there were 67 UFO sightings from the Watchtower in the month of November.
Oh, wow.
And that area where she is the Mysterious Valley. And I don't know if you've ever read Christopher O'Brien's book called The Mysterious Valley, but that's the area that he wrote about of all the UFO
yeah.
sightings in that valley. And that's where Hooper is located.
Yeah.
And she said that in the month of November they had 67 recorded sightings.
That's amazing.
So if you want to see some UFOs, and I'm not sure who else will be there, but just check out the website, and if you want to take a mini vacation or something and camp out, we're all going to be there.
Sounds like fun. I wish I could.
Yeah,
maybe
I think
I'll,
it will be.
So check my itinerary. Maybe I could make it out there for that.
Oh, that would be great.
Well,
do a show from there.
I would love to. I think that would be amazing.
Yeah.
Folks should check out UFOWatchtower.com for more on that event, and also check out sixkiller.com, that's your website, for more on your work. So and I can't thank you enough, Artie. This has been really an amazing 2 hours, and it flew by. I'm stunned that we've gone 2 hours 15 minutes here. It has gone by like lightning fast, and I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation.
Well, I enjoyed talking to you, and I really appreciate all the good things you had to say about my book.
Absolutely. I love the book. And, folks, it's Encounters with Star People. It's from Anomalist Books. Just punch it into your Google. You'll be able to find it. It is fantastic. It's an absolute must-read. And I purposely try to avoid getting into too many of the stories, because I want folks to go out and get this book, because it is tremendous. And like I said, Artie, I've loved this conversation. Cannot wait to put it out there for the BOA Audio listeners, and I cannot thank you enough once again for coming on the show.
Well, you're sure welcome.
That does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big, big thanks to Artie Sixkiller Clark for coming on the show and giving us so much time. Be sure to check out her website, www.sixkiller.com. Pretty simple, all one word, sixkiller.com. And you definitely want to go out and get your hands on Encounters with Star People. Fantastic book. It is from Anomalist Books. You can find that on Amazon or at anomalistbooks.com. Seriously, folks, you're going to love this book. It is a must-have for any serious student of the UFO phenomenon. Moving right along now, it's time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback, and since we are well overdue with this edition of the program, we are going to eschew listener feedback this week. We had a good run there of episodes coming out on time and packed with great listener feedback, so it was only a matter of time
before we ended up having to do one of these short end caps because we were late putting the program out. 1,000 apologies. We're going to get back on a more timely schedule very soon. It has been an intense week here for me, doing a lot of non-BOA work. And as such, I want to get this program out to folks as soon as possible. So no listener feedback here this week, but let me give you the rundown on how to get in touch with me. You can write to boaaudio@hotmail.com. You can head on over to banalofamerica.com and click the contact button. Or you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. It is BOA's paranormal playground, theusofe.com. Join up and join in on the conversations there. Additionally, I am on Facebook and Twitter, so just punch in Binall, B-I-N-N-A-L-L, and you'll find me there. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of our online circle of friends. And finally, please allow me to plug Binall of America on Facebook. We are up to 931 likes, so we're not even really within reaching distance of 1,000. But I'm hoping we'll get there in the next few weeks. If you have not liked us yet on Facebook, please do so. And be sure to check out the awesome postings from BOA audio listeners on the Facebook page, as well as updates from me regarding follow-up stuff from the program and interesting news articles of note with relation to previous editions of the show. Before we move into the next segment, I will say we got tons of feedback to the John Rhodes edition of the program, so I will dig into the mailbag on the next BOA audio to talk about that, as well as whatever feedback we get here to the RD6 Killer Clark edition of the program, as well as any thoughts or insights from the BOA audio listeners on the program as a whole. Up next, please allow me to thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. Starting this week and moving forward, we'll be adding a new name here to the credits of the program. That is Ray Weigel, who has come on the team here to help us revamp Binall of America. So stay tuned to the website. Big thanks to Ray. He is a talented web aficionado, and he is already hard at work on giving Binall of America a fresh coat of paint. Our buddy Jeremy Boston is going to stay on as our graphics consultant. Stay tuned to BOA. Big things are afoot. And we've got new columns already posted from Marla Pena, and we got a new one coming up from Regan Lee as well. Binall of America, make it a part of your everyday search for esoteric news and opinion. Now comes the time in the program where I take my hat off and pass it around to the BOA audio listeners and ask you to make a donation to the Binall of America franchise. How do you do that? That's simple. There are two ways to help us out. You can head on over to Binall of America and click the PayPal button. That's safe, secure, and simple, and they will walk you through the donation process. But what if you don't trust the internet and you want to make a snail mail donation? You can do that via the BOA P.O. Box. Simply send your donation to Tim Binall, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. And you can find the complete address under the PayPal button at Binall of America. As always, it bears repeating, my friends, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards keeping Binall of America and BOA Audio up and running, freely available, and commercial-free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of BOA Audio, we are going international once again with another program that is long overdue, taped way back in the summer, but it has been sitting on my hard drive here for far too long. Our guest is Andrew Nicholson, the man behind Weird Australia, and we are going to be examining just a myriad of wild stories from the land down under. And it is a fascinating look at the world of the paranormal in Australia with Andrew Nicholson. That's on the next edition of the program. We return to the land down under to learn about weird Australia with Andrew Nicholson. And on that note, we close the book on this edition of the program. Big, big thanks once again to Artie Sixkiller Clark for coming on the show. And, of course, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA audio listeners, the folks who tune in to the very end of the program. Thank you for your enduring support of Banal of America. It is truly appreciated. And, of course, thank you once again for making BOA audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.